Welcome to Holden Village and another taping of a lecture that's being held here. This is all taking place in the Koinonia room, our Koinonia building, I should say, the fireside room. And this is Charles Lane, and he's speaking on the west and Central Park to Yellowstone. So let's tune in on Charles and hear what he has to say.
For those of you who don't know, I'm Charles Lane, in the village for a couple weeks as earth scientist. And my session for this week carries the broad theme of Abbey's Road Revisited, the American West. And today we've entitled this Central Park Yellowstone. I tried to make this as catchy a title as I could so that you could be attracted to this. And the genesis of all of this came about 4 weeks ago. I was flying back from San Francisco to Dallas, and I picked up the San Francisco newspaper and was in the editorial page section, which is where I usually go to first because that's usually the best entertainment you can get out of newspapers anymore. And lo and behold, there was an article in there, editorial article in there, about our Secretary of the Interior, Bruce Babbitt, and how Bruce Babbitt was toying with the idea that he would expand upon the fledgling efforts that you now see in Yosemite and south rim of the Grand Canyon to cut down on the vehicular traffic into the park, basically put up a big parking lot on the outskirts of the park, and then bring people in via public transportation to cut down on the total number of vehicles running in or out and cutting down on the congestion. I'm sure those of you who've been in Yosemite know this, that the vehicular congestion is just amazing. Well, of course, the editorial writer's point, and the thing that also jumped into my mind, is that here we were 25 years after the fact making a profit out of Edward Abbey. Because that was Abbey's call 25 years or so ago in 1968 when he gave us Desert Solitaire.
Who was Abbey?
Edward Abbey is the 20th century's outgrowth of John Muir in some respects. Abbey passed away a couple years ago and has left us an interesting array of fiction and nonfiction. His fictional works I'm not anywhere near as fond of as his nonfiction, but he's kind of the late 20th century American naturalist philosopher that would have come out from that late 19th century. He's not quite the religious man that Thoreau would have been about the spiritual elements of his thinking, but a passionate advocate for the American West. And if you have never read Desert Solitaire, you can see this one's well-worn. I just borrowed this out of our library. If you've never read Edward Abbey, he's extraordinarily rough around the edges, but has some interesting things to say. Starting on about page 45 in this book is his polemic about the national parks and industrial tourism. Here was what he proposed to put up as a billboard to the entrance to the parks. It would say, "Howdy folks, welcome. This is your national park, established for the pleasure of you and all people everywhere. Park your car, jeep, truck, tank, motorbike, snowmobile, motorboat, jet boat, airboat, submarine, airplane, jet plane, helicopter, hovercraft, winged motorcycle, rocket ship, or any other conceivable type of motorized vehicle in the world's biggest parking lot behind the comfort station immediately to your rear. Get out of your motorized vehicle, get on your horse, mule, bicycle, or feet, and come on in." This is what he has a number of suggestions in this chapter. This is a suggestion about what to do with park rangers. Put the park rangers to work. Lazy, scheming loafers, they've wasted too many years selling tickets at toll booths and sitting behind desks filling out charts and tables in the vain effort to appease the mania for statistics which torments the Washington office. Put them to work. They're supposed to be rangers. Make the bums range. Kick them out of those overheated, air-conditioned offices. Yank them out of those overstuffed patrol cars. and drive them out on the trails where they should be, leading the dudes over hill and dale safely into and back out of the wilderness. It won't hurt them to work off a little office fat. It'll do them good. Help them take their minds off each other's wives and give them a chance to get out of reach of the boss. A blessing for all concerned. So he's a little rough around the edges. They will be needed on the trail. Once we outlaw the motors and stop the road building and force the multitudes back on their feet, the people will need leaders. A venturesome minority, I can't possibly identify with this one, will always be eager to set off on their own, and no obstacles should be placed in their path. Let them take risks, for God's sake. Let them get lost, sunburned, stranded, drowned, eaten by bears, buried alive under avalanches. This is the right and privilege of any free American. But the rest, the majority, most of them new to the outdoors, will need and welcome assistance, instruction, and guidance. So this was Edward Abbey in 1968, and the San Francisco newspaper about a month ago was Bruce Babbitt toying with the idea of really doing just some of the things that Abbey had proposed first at that point in time. If there's only one book that you ever read by Edward Abbey, this should be it, Desert Solitaire. Still kind of a timeless classic, even all these years later, and a lot more in here in terms of his thoughts on the parks.
Is the whole book about the national parks and how to use them?
There is a great deal in here about the national parks and how to use it. There are chapters in here. A lot of these chapters will just stand alone, so you can pick and choose. But Desert Solitaire is subtitled A Season in the Wilderness, and it has to do with the time that Edward Abbey spent as a park ranger in what was at that time Arches National Monument, mm-hmm. which he called Arches National Money Mint. His thoughts on industrial tourism, which we'll get to here in just a second as well. But as I was thinking about this, and what to do with this for this session, I thought it might be kind of interesting to take a look back through the genesis of the national park system, how we got here from there, and what some people are thinking about in terms of the problems, the rights, the wrongs, and what we might do about it. And so if you'll bear with me a second, let me take you through a little history of the national parks, as soon as I find my green pen. Let me take you a little history of the national parks and take you through some things you may not have known. Last half of the 19th century, starting about 1850, 1860, impress upon you that there was a very unique genesis. I'll tell you all this in case you can't read my writing. A unique genesis to the formation of these parks. One, because there was absolutely no tradition anywhere in the world of a rural park. There was absolutely no tradition of this anywhere. This is an American invention. The tradition of a rural park out away from the city center is an American invention. Europeans still appreciate this, and if you stop and think about it a sec, you can go to any number of the national parks of the West about this time of year, and you'll see the Germans and the French and the Swiss and the Austrians all over them. When we were in Arches a couple years back, and the van stopped down in the laundromat, there wasn't any English being spoken there anywhere. And of course, the thing that surprised the kids more than anything else was the Europeans' lack of inhibition. They were sitting there in their underwear while their clothes were in the dryers. That's real education for my girls. But there was no tradition of rural parks prior to this point in time. And the other thing that you have to kind of keep in mind, that there was no popular movement in this country to establish them. There really was no popular movement in this country to establish them. Came about with several disparate groups and a couple of three different underpinnings or undercurrents to this. There was this undercurrent of what we could call religious, how do I spell that? Religious, is that right? Religious naturalism. There was a certain spirit of religious naturalism, Thoreauian to start with, but practiced in the last half of the 19th century by his heir apparent in the American West, who would have been John Muir.
Muir.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I-O-U-S, Charles.
I-O-U-S, thank you. G-S. And my other big bugaboo is vegetable. For some reason, I keep wanting to put an I in there instead of the E. This sense of religious naturalism, that Muir was the carrier of that through the last half of the century. There was a certain sense of reaction to the development of the West that was developed. Developing, that was coming out in the last half of the century. And there was a certain sense of nationalism at work, and I'm going to tell you how that plays, nationalism. There's a certain sense of nationalism that came in by boosters of the West with respect to, you know, we want to be a civilized nation, we want to compete with all the nations of Europe, that this is a civilized place that we're building out here. And you can look at this one sort of as being driven by boosters, the people that really want to develop the West. And you could look at these two as being driven by the forces of conservation and preservation in the West. What this actually did through the last half of the last century was produce an alliance of boosters, conservationists, and Congress, three groups that you're not going to have any luck getting together at this point in time. But you got all of these things working together in the last half of the last century, pretty much because the population was so sparse and these places were so remote that they could all kind of work on this stuff together.
Maybe this was later and you're coming to it, but it seems to me there was a fourth element, and that was the boosterism of commercial interests like James J. Hill, who really created Glacier National Park so that people would ride his railroad.
Well, I'm glad you started this, because I'm just about set to ask you a question that basically is just that.
From St. Paul.
Sure. Glacier came just a little bit later.
About 1913, was it?
Right.
Yeah.
But let's go back a little earlier. Let's go all the way back to the 1860s, and let me ask you a question. Let's go back to the 1860s. Let's go to Yosemite and the Big Woods, Redwoods, and let me ask you what seems to be an obvious question after all I've said so far. Who do you suppose it was, an individual, that went to Congress, United States, at that point in time, and said, let's make a national park, or let's reserve all this area as a park for the United States in the area of Yosemite? Let's do this. Who do you suppose said that?
In 1860? That's very early.
That's very early, yeah.
California was a state for, what, 10 years?
Yeah, 1848, so not very long, yeah. Yeah, who do you suppose said that?
Was it a Californian?
Sort of, yeah.
Sort of?
Well, it was not John Muir. Too early.
Yeah.
It was not John Muir. Let me throw this at you. Israel Raymond. Well, that sets off bells, doesn't it?
Never heard of it.
Never heard of it. The Central American Steamship Transit.
Again.
That's who first went there. Hmm. And he was their San Francisco representative on the West Coast. That's where it first came from. And Abby knew all this, and that's been his long-running polemic about industrial tourism. Mm-hmm. This guy was after industrial tourism.
To ship people from the East to the West. And
then out of San Francisco over to Yosemite.
Yeah.
He and Hill must have been together.
Yeah.
Well, Hill was 50 years later.
Right. Yeah. It's the same story.
Yeah, it's the same story. This yeah. And right. There was a real element of boosterism in all of this.
Now it's a steamship company.
So this was way back. in the 60s that this guy got going. Well, the original statutes, and we're going to kind of play this one for a minute, but as people started to work this thing, some of the original statutes developed long before the national parks came into existence were for public use without impairment. That's the phrase. Public use without impairment.
That's legislative language?
That's legislative language. You can divide this into two parts, right? You can take the public use part, and you can take the without impairment part, and you kind of see where this goes, you know, toward the boosters on one side and the conservation crowd on the other side. Here's the story now of From Central Park to Yellowstone, hence the title. 1865, in steps another player, a gentleman by the name of, I'll just abbreviate this, Frederick Law
Olmsted.
What's he famous for?
Central Park.
Central Park.
Yeah, Manhattan.
This is the man who built Central Park in Manhattan, had been to Europe, had studied all of those European parks, came back to New York and gave us Central Park, which is no mean thing.
Yeah.
It's a lovely spot. Okay. Frederick Law Olmsted gave us, at that point in time, the philosophical basis for the establishment of the national parks. I mean, this is drumroll symbol teen time right here. This is the philosophical basis for the establishment of the national parks. Ready? You'll like this language, as a matter of fact, because he said that what we're after here is the invocation. Boy, that sounds like pastor talk. The invocation of the, are you ready? Contemplative faculty. The invocation of the contemplative faculty. Does that sound at all familiar to, you know, things around here? Is there anybody who's having a hard time following that statement? This was the philosophical basis for the establishment of the national parks, the invocation of the contemplative faculty. We're going to come back to this just in a moment and see how this stacks up with respect to current practice.
Is that a quote from Olmsted?
That's a quote from Olmsted, yes. That is a quote from Frederick Law Olmsted. He wished the invocation of the contemplative faculty. I mean, how many park rangers do you hear bandying that around? Yes, well, let's instill the invocation of the contemplative faculty. Let's instill the contemplative faculty here. This was a long time in coming. This was a long time in coming. Anybody with an idea of the date of establishment of the Park Service?
Well, the Park Service, I think, was a different date, but Yellowstone was 72.
Yellowstone was 72, first and largest of the contiguous 48 state parks, about 2.2 million acres, which is pretty substantial. Established in 72, the Park Service does not come into existence until 1916. Now, you want to know who ran Yellowstone for the first 44 years of its life?
No.
United States Cavalry.
The military.
The military ran it for the first 44 years of its life.
Was this their invocational?
Gee, I don't know. Several things happened here that...
Well, the West was kind of turned over to the U.S. Military for a long period.
For a long time, and some of the great early explorers, of course, Colonel Fremont, going through Utah, John Wesley Powell, Zebulon Pike, and Long, another, I think, lieutenant, for which Long's Peak is named after there in Colorado. Of course, Zebulon Pike.
Pike's Peak.
Pike's Peak, traveling across western Kansas and eastern Colorado and calling that the Great American Desert because he hadn't made it to the depths of the Mojave yet.
But Lake Powell.
Lake Powell.
His name for
John Wesley. Sure. A lot of this at the hands of the military. Several things to throw at you, or a couple of things anyway to throw at you that are players here. 1891 brought us the Forestry Reserve Act. And out of this comes one of our next big players, who is Gifford Pinchot. Name you may realize this or have heard of before. But this is where we got all the national forests. This is when we started reserving all the national forest lands in a big way.
Did that also create the Forest Service, that act?
And this act actually started the Forest Service on its way, and Pinchot is as initial director of it. Okay? So this came before the national parks. Another thing that came before the national parks in 1906, we had something called the Antiquities Act, believe it or not. Antiquities Act. Chuck, always help me out if I spell wrong here. And out of this came the National Monuments as a separate thing than the national parks. So like Death Valley National Monument, separate thing. This act was a different thing. And the wording was setting aside sites on federal land with, quote, historic, scientific, scenic values. Okay. So this is a national monument. All right. So this kind of closes out the end of the 19th century. And we actually roll into the 20th before we get real busy about the establishment of the Park Service itself. Things get going in earnest, actually, in 1912. Okay. 1912, John Muir is back in the saddle here again. The establishment of the Sierra Club is about 20 years earlier, 1892. And John Muir and the Sierra Club are pushing very hard for the establishment of a Bureau of National Parks. John Muir and the Sierra Club are going head-to-head with Gifford Pinchot in 1912. At this point in time, because Pinchot is thinking that the Bureau of National Parks rightfully belongs within the U.S. Forestry Service. It seemed like the natural place to him. Muir is pushing very hard for this not to happen because there is this slight problem out in the Sierra of California between Pinchot and Muir that is known as Hetch Hetchy. Who's that news to? Who've never heard the name Hetch Hetchy before? Okay. Hetch Hetchy can be looked at in a couple of ways at the same time. With respect to the Sierra Club, it was probably the most devastating loss for the Sierra Club in terms of fights that it took on and did not win. But at the same time, it's what gave the Sierra Club enormous notoriety and really kicked it off as the viable organization it is today. Hetch Hetchy now is a lake-filled, or actually a reservoir-filled valley in the Sierra of California that is part of, at this point in time, the San Francisco city water supply. At the time, it was about the only San Francisco city water supply. We won't get into discussion on San Andreas Lake actually on the peninsula now and how it actually sits on top of the San Andreas Fault, worrying about all the distribution problems that will happen with a big earthquake right there. That's another story. But Hetch Hetchy is up in the northern end of Yosemite, And John Muir, in his writing, having been through that area before it was dammed up, considered the Hetch Hetchy Valley to be every bit as scenic and perhaps even more so than Yosemite Valley itself. And he fought very, very hard for the preservation of Hetch Hetchy and lost. Pinchot, who was a very utilitarian sort of fellow, saw the need for San Francisco to have a water supply, and so he was pushing very hard to get Hetch Hetchy through. He actually won that battle.
Was it in a forest preserve, the valley?
Well, it was in a forest, yeah, part, and I don't know which of the Sierra forests that is now. Actually, now it is in the Yosemite Park. It actually is in the park itself, but it was in lands that
Pinchot had some
right
responsibility for.
Right. Right. John Muir's biggest loss, and really a thing that bothered him until the end of his life that he had lost that, because he thought it was just about the most scenic place he had ever seen in North America, and he'd been a lot of places. So he'd lost out on Hetch Hetchy. 1914 comes along, and a fellow named Stephen Mather, M-A-T-H-E-R, of Chicago, writes the Secretary of the Interior and says, I'd like to run this new National Park Service in 1916. It happens, many of you who have gone to the south rim of the Grand Canyon, the first parking lot you pull into, that first overview in the canyon, you are standing at Mather Point. Okay, so that actually takes you up through the formation of the Park Service. And kind of keep in mind that public use without impairment clause, because I'd like to jump ahead quite a few years to another book that I would recommend for you to read. This one was written, and I can't remember for sure, either in 1981 or 1982, something like that, by a man named Joseph Sax, just like short for the saxophone. His book is entitled Mountains, abbreviate that, Without Handrails. And he's taken a close look at this public use without impairment and Olmsted's original philosophic statement about the invocation of the contemplative faculty. And as he wrote this book, he was arguing from the position that the Park Service's unending efforts to be all things to all people simply cannot work. That public use is defined by boosters, and without impairment by conservations are simply antithetical entities, and that they cannot work. That you cannot be all things to all people. And the Park Service has struggled mightily over the years, I think, in a very difficult position. I have no interest in bad-mouthing the Park Service at all, because I think they have one of the most difficult jobs from a philosophical standpoint of anybody in the nation. Sachs has some suggestions about what to do with this. Let me throw some of these at you. This is a good place for all kinds of comment, but let me throw this at you and see if there's anything here you'd like to chew on a little bit. He starts from the fundamental premise that the Park Service cannot be all things to all people. His next step is to, and this is of course the tricky part, define people. And he is going to generalize, here, for what they are, but he is going to generalize, and he's going to use some familiar terms, and it's not an exact fit, but he's going to use some familiar terms. He's going to talk about what he calls the blue-collar ethic and what he calls the white-collar ethic. And again, he must generalize, he must be able to get a handle on what he's about to do. Let's see if this makes any sense to you as I go through some of this stuff. it's not that everybody who works in a blue-collar job has a blue-collar ethic or vice versa, but he's going to define the ethics. And his premise here is that if you are a blue-collar worker, what you do at your work, you don't have a whole lot of control over. That if you're working on the assembly line, you've got the shift boss who says, do this, do this, do this, do that. And you do that 8 to 5, 5 days a week, all of your working life. You don't have much control over what you do. And that's how he would define a blue-collar ethic. The white-collar ethic, by comparison, is a professional person who can actually plot their course, her or his course, a little better. And they, in fact, do have more control over their work, their life, their working life in particular. He says this is reflected in how you recreate. These two different attitudes or these two different approaches are reflected in how you recreate. Let's try this on for size, and I think you'll get this very quickly. You got two people, one with the blue collar ethic, one with the white collar ethic. They both like to get out on the water, right? And so let's pick on some nice mountain lake. Chelan might work, Lake of the Woods in southern Oregon, big lakes. All right, so the white collar worker, who in fact has a great deal of control over what they do with their everyday life, their professional life, wants to go to this lake and experience it on its own terms. In other words, there is no control of nature here. There is a desire to adapt to nature, experience nature on its own terms. How is this reflected in somebody who likes to get out on the water? It's reflected by the white-collar worker getting out here on a sailboat. Right? You're at the mercy of the winds. It develops your skills as a sailor. You're going to take nature as it comes to you, and you're going to adapt to that. In comparison, the blue-collar worker will get out there with their big power boat and go where they will, when they will, how fast they will, and it's a subjection or subduing of nature. And of course, if you're the white-collar ethic type who's out here sailing, of course, one of the things you want is a little peace and quiet so you can hear the waves lapping against the hull and the birds and all this stuff. And it's a little hard to do that when the folks next door are zooming by in their powerboat. Okay? So you see how this thing plays out. If you have this white-collar ethic about forest trails that you want to stroll on foot, then the blue-collar person who wants to control nature is going to be out there on their motorized dirt bike. Okay? This is his thesis. And again, it's a very broad generality, but it's a way to get a handle on the thing. It's a way to get a handle on the thing. And from this stems his position that the Park Service simply cannot be all things to all people because the desires are virtually antithetical. But if you want to go sailing and have peace and quiet, you can't have power boats running all over the lake around you.
Snowmobiles versus snowshoes.
Sure. Yeah, it just...
Voyageurs.
Sure. It just keeps rolling along down the line. It just keeps rolling down the line. You can just keep on thinking of these examples. Okay. So this is how he frames his discussion, is in these terms. Okay. Now, what does he propose to do about it? Okay. What he proposes to do about it looks something like this. We create this sort of pyramidal structure, and that's a lopsided pyramid, but you'll get the hint. Various kinds of public lands in the American West. Various kinds of public lands in the American West. And if you start dividing them up on the basis of the lands occupied, start breaking them up on the basis of the lands occupied, in other words, how much land you have, you can sort of build the base of the pyramid down here with BLM lands.
Bureau of Land Management lands, you can come up a step and get into the National Forest lands, okay, in terms of acreages there. And it's not quite as clear in terms of land size once we get to the top, but in terms of his vision for how all this is used, you can come into the National Monument in here, and then finally the jewel of the crown, the pinnacle of the federal lands, the choicest of the choice, are going to be the national parks up here. And this is how he would structure this thing. And his argument is that if you cannot have these compatible aims, you cannot, you know, if a blue color ethic, white color ethic, you know, those are incompatible desires. The one desire to experience nature on its own terms, the other to control nature and recreate the way I want to, because this is my time. You know, I'm working for the boss 4 hours a week. That's not my time. This is my time. I want to be in control. I have this need to be in control. It says, if you can't do that, then at least save the top of the pyramid here. His argument is save that for the white collar ethic, and let the blue collar ethic have a lot more room on the other types of federal lands. That dirt bike parks, if you will, motorized vehicles on trails, motorized craft on waterways, let them have this. A lot more land to choose from. A lot more land to choose from. But let's honor Olmsted's philosophical justification for the parks. Let's honor that invocation of the contemplative faculty. Let's focus on that without impairment clause for the national parks and leave them be. Let's experience them on their own terms. And I've just given you Sachs's 200-page book in short with that. How does that sound? What do you think of this sort of idea?
What's the ratio of actual acreage that he envisioned for that setup?
Well, in this setup, the ratio is stacked very heavily toward the bottom of the pyramid. That's why it shows that pyramidal shape. I don't have any exact numbers, but if you were to look, and such maps are available, if you were to look at a map of Washington State, say, you would see marked out in one color the Bureau of Land Management lands and in another the National Forests. And what do we have? Vernier and North Cascades.
And North Cascades.
On the National Parks. I think St. Helens is a volcanic monument still.
Yeah, is it under the Forest Service now or the National Park Service? I think it's the latter.
I think the monuments are now under the control of the National Park Service.
Yeah.
But there is a distinction. National monuments have certain land use practices to them that are denied in the parks. You can get cattle grazing, actually still in some of the parks, but things like mining operations, this sort of stuff, can be carried on in the national monuments and not in the national parks.
Well, that's one of the reasons people who are fighting for the national monuments always try to get them moved up.
Moved up.
So that there's more protection.
Becomes and a more restricted.
Isn't Death Valley now about to become a national park?
Well, it's getting closer all the time.
It's in a bill in the Congress.
Yes,
yeah.
It's getting closer.
And Joshua Tree.
And Joshua Tree is
another
one. Well.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the other big designation are all the wilderness areas. And
right.
Really that relates to usage. The national parks typically have easy access, high numbers of people. So the wilderness is a whole other separate designation.
Usually managed by the Forest Service,
right.
The wilderness areas, usually just like we have right down the road here.
But that's the area where probably has the most restriction of anything.
There are some pretty fair restrictions. I mean, you can't even ride your bicycle past that
that entrance.
And numbers of people per day who can go on trails. And
all that sort of stuff.
Does he give any ratio of the demand of people who want white collar activities to blue collar activities?
Not really. Not really. You know, he's arguing. He's trying to make this as palatable to everyone as he can, and I think he really, in the effort at balance, in some respects, to me, he becomes a little unbalanced. He is willing to give up on some of the restrictions, say, that you have in the wilderness areas or in lands administered by the Forest Service. He's willing to give some of that up if we can make the parks more restrictive, the national parks more restrictive than what they are right now. And his argument for that is that this is la prime de la prime. You know, this is the...
Well, he's certainly given more land to the blue collar activities. And
right.
That's what, is there more demand
right.
for those activities?
Right.
The criticism, of course, that's leveled at it is that it's elitist and it saves the best, the jewel, the crown and the jewel, for all the kind of yuppie intellectual types who are white collar and not the masses for what they want to do.
Which is why I think he's gone so far. And he's sensitive to that criticism of elitism, which is why he's so willing to ease restrictions on all the rest of this stuff, so that he can say, look, you know, here's all this BLM land and Forest Service land and all this stuff that you can do all these different things with. To recreate in order to try to respond to that. Yeah, that would be the charge.
But it isn't just elitist, it's physical ability. Should the people 80 years old have the same access as the people
that's
20
years old? That's a kind of elitism.
Years old.
Elitism of physically able.
That's another aspect.
Actually, Abby had thought that through a little bit in his book, and he is not, what he... He did. He did argue for the public transport, the public access, but the access via public transport. And one of the interesting things to me, as you go through all this stuff, I have hiked the Grand Canyon. I went to school at Northern Arizona, and I actually did part of my master's thesis in the Grand Canyon. I've been in the Grand Canyon dozens of times. But you know, Phantom Ranch is down there at the very bottom. And getting down or up those trails is not an easy thing to do. But the thing that, by federal mandate, the Park Service must make all restrooms handicap accessible. So there's this bathroom down at Phantom Ranch. Okay. And of course you have all this rocky ground, broken trail, and all this sort of stuff. But right at the restroom you have this beautiful wheelchair ramp to get up into the bathroom. And I guess if you were capable of riding the mule down and packing a wheelchair on the back.
Or the raft, if you could.
Or the raft. Or I guess if you wanted to pay for a helicopter, they've got a helicopter landing pad. There, and I guess if you want to pay for the helicopter seat, you could go to Phantom Ranch. You certainly won't have any trouble getting into the bathroom.
You know, another issue that the Voyager Park in northern Minnesota is dealing with this year is the elitist thing of having to portage your own canoe versus getting dogs in there to pull it across for you. And that's an issue they're working on this summer now.
In the winter.
Abby's vision of all of this in 68, he was way at the back of Arches, back there where the campground is now. You've got to drive all the way back to get in there. And he really didn't want his view spoiled by pollution from the automobiles, the noise pollution from the automobiles. He certainly had no qualms about a pack animal of some kind coming into pack people or equipment in. That did not bother him in the slightest. His big thing was getting the motorized traffic out of it. And I think what he was looking at was he wanted people who were serious about it to be there. And I think that, again, this is one of the things that the Park Service fights with, and I think it is reasonably sensitive too. I don't think you want to deny access to a handicapped person. But you want people to come in here who are serious about being here and want to come experience this. I mean, you always see the thing about driving through and hitting all five or six or seven of the national parks in southern Utah, you know, just driving in the car and driving through to say you've been there, this sort of thing. And Abby detested that kind of thing. The idea was to get there and get out of your car and take a walk around and see. So, you know, I think there are answers to some of those elitist charges about physical elitism. I think there are some answers to that.
I do too.
As a matter of fact. And I don't think the Park Service or Sacks or anybody else is insensitive to that either.
I think bringing, one of the issues is bringing dogs in to that area. What does it do to the native animals? Mm-hmm. Which is different than bringing mules in.
Right. What do you do with those dogs? Do you turn them loose, or is it, you know, like a working dog that you keep under fairly tight constraint? This sort of stuff. So, I've seen some movement in this direction. Do we have any Southern Californians here today? No Southerns? As you come north out of Los Angeles on the road up toward Bakersfield, you go through the town of Gorman, which unfortunately sits basically right on the San Andreas. Or unfortunately is on the San Andreas because that's where they put the motorcycle dirt bike park, and there are these big hills up there. And the state, this is a state operation, but the state of California said, okay, let's put a place where the dirt bikers can dirt bike to their heart's content. And it's not that far off the highway, so that you'd have the highway noise anyway. And there are some great hills for the dirt biking out there. But the idea is to keep the dirt bikers away from the up at the top of Fraser Park in the Ventura County Wilderness, off of those trails where people prefer to cross-country ski. So there is that movement in that direction. What else? This is, I've probably leave enough time for discussion, so what else with some of this stuff?
Well, to go back to something I brought up earlier, I'm just fascinated by the James J. Hill phenomenon in Glacier Park, and for many years, the railroad not only operated the railroad to bring tourists there, but operated all the hotels in the park. And apparently with federal government permission, obviously, and I think the concession company that operates it today, well, it was like a concession to James J. Hill. And the Great Northern Railroad made a lot of money from that. And Amtrak still goes that way.
Yes.
And some of us have taken groups and stopped at Glacier on the way to Holden because that's where the train goes. Was there a debate at the time about whether that was appropriate, that kind of private-public partnership?
Not as large a one as John Muir would have wished for.
Or as there would be today, probably.
As there would be today. This would not really have been expedited in the fashion it was without the element of boosterism. As you point out, it was not only Yosemite with Israel Raymond, but a fellow named Nettleton, who was with the Northern, Great Northern, was one of the first people to suggest Yellowstone, as a matter of fact. So this boosterism has played a big part, and so you have things like Fred Harvey Enterprises that run these concessions every place that you turn around. And, of course, this is something that just drove Abby nuts, and his contention that the National Park Service has always been in the business of, quote, industrial tourism. Mm-hmm. That's what he has called it. Mather, when he first took the job, is credited with a quote that says, national parks are good for American business.
Yeah.
As well.
And they have been.
Even Nixon, Teddy Roosevelt, now he's a great promoter. How did he fit into all that? Doesn't that all kind of go together?
Teddy was a great promoter as well. Interestingly enough, and I'll touch a little bit on this tomorrow, we'll talk a little bit about the history of conservation in the West, but this Forestry Reserve Act in 1891, Congress later repealed that, and Roosevelt had the opportunity to veto it out of hand and did not. What he did do, though, is from about 6 p.m. the night before and all through the night with Pinchot until about 8 the following morning, he set aside some 16 or 20 million acres of forestry land, and then he signed the bill that forbid him to do it anymore. So he took care he took care of it. So he was very much a booster, and I don't think that he saw anything particularly wrong with this public-private type of relationship and the building of concessions. And I think between Roosevelt and Pinchot both taking that position, Juan Muir was somewhat overwhelmed. Way at the back.
Yes, in California, I was quite surprised to find that PG&E has these wonderful campgrounds and whatever available to the public.
What is PG&E?
Pacific Gas and Electric Company. Utility. And I don't know if that's available in other parts of the country. Now, we have a family here in town, here in Holden Down. Steve Bennett, and I don't think he's here, but he's in the village right now in management, and I don't know if any of you would like to talk to him about what PG&E offers as another alternative to private lands, and PG&E, to my knowledge, doesn't even charge for that, the usage of these,
correct,
which gives an option for either one of those groups, white or blue, but it might be fun to explore that with him. And how about any other parts of the country? Do the utilities provide that for the public?
I have seen that in a couple other parts of the country, yes,
yeah,
where they will in fact do that. That actually reminds me of a couple of promotional spots I want to get in before we quit. One is that if you are here Saturday morning, one book I have ordered up, I'm not sure if it's in yet, is a book entitled Rocky Mountain Divide, The Selling and Saving of the West, and that's going to be Saturday morning's topic. And in it, I'm going to try and chart the development of the private land trusts, things operating today to actually put together private lands into a conservancy. The Nature Conservancy would be involved in this sort of stuff. But a cookbook type of thing, the kinds of things that people are doing to put together private land trusts for land conservation. And Rocky Mountain Divide is the title of the book because it contrasts Colorado and Utah, where in Colorado, with very much a back-to-nature sort of movement, the private land trusts are booming and putting aside thousands and thousands of acres. And over in Utah, with the Mormon imperative from Isaiah to make the desert bloom and have dominion in the westernized sense of the word, have dominion over land, private land trusts are virtually non-existent in these adjacent states. So that's going Saturday morning. The other thing that I'll promo is that tonight's forum topic here at Holden Village is something entitled, How Busy is Too Busy? Speaking of the invocation of the contemplative faculty. And part of the discussion will center upon what technology is bringing to Holden Village and what we want to do about it. And Ms. Lutzfield will be happy to have you sound out on some of these things, but can kind of tie together with some of this discussion, as a matter of fact. So if you're free this evening, that I think will be an excellent forum here in the village. What else before we go to lunch? Hopefully this has been somewhat an educative experience.
Well, how do you feel about the proposal to limit private vehicular traffic in the big parks, at least, and to use public transportation?
Like in Denali.
I think it's an excellent idea.
Denali does it.
And more and more heading that way. I think it's an excellent idea. I think anyone who has camped in the Yosemite Valley in the past 4 or 5 years, as compared to having camped in the Yosemite Valley 10 or 15 years ago, will testify that it's not worth it anymore. The traffic, the congestion, the noise is just unbearable. Who was it, and what would they say to us about what Yosemite camping is now?
Ghetto
camping. They call it Yosemite ghetto camping.
Yosemite limit private vehicular traffic.
It is now, and the
but
thing,
what they do is they get as many people as they can, and then it goes, but you're still 6 feet from
you're right on top of each other in camping.
really, it's no different than what's happening in the cities with public transportation. Universities limit traffic, and so on.
Sure, the downtown, bring back the downtown urban revitalization, the downtown malls, same this thing. Kind of stuff. Same kind of thing. I'm all for it. I think it's...
Denali's having problems with trying to keep a group from building a road in because there's private land surrounded by public
land. Mm-hmm. Right.
And they are demanding, I think, a road into their private land.
And for commercial development.
For commercial
development. They want to sell lodging and food.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I've left you a little bit of something to think about. If you get the opportunity, you might read Joseph Sack's book. It's an interesting approach. And, you know, somebody who's trying to take a stab at how to handle this and make everybody happy. And see where that might take you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.